The headlines: the Yemeni rights group says mines and cluster bombs left by the Saudi-led coalition have killed 108 civilians and injured over 200 others since April. The British Prime Minister is under mounting pressure over an economic crisis exacerbated by rising energy prices as many businesses face bankruptcy. And thousands of Moldovans hold a massive rally in protest at high inflation and fuel prices, demanding the resignation of the country's pro-Western government. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Yemeni people have been enduring years-long sufferings of Saudi-led aggression, and since the start of a fragile truce, hundreds of more civilians have fallen victim to planted mines or leftover cluster bombs. The Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center confirmed that mines, cluster bombs, and other explosive remnants used by the coalition have killed 108 civilians and injured 216 others. According to YEMAC, the number of casualties has increased because the explosive remnants are found in large swaths of the country. It also attributed the increase to the return of the displaced Yemenis to those affected areas. The center says it needs mine detectors and other essential equipment to dispose of the planted mines and cluster bombs. The UN-backed truce in Yemen came into effect in April and was extended until early October. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is no longer expected to attend Queen Elizabeth's funeral. A British Foreign Office source said the change in plans was made by Saudi Arabia without mentioning any reason. The British government faced a barrage of criticism for inviting the Saudi Crown Prince to attend the Queen's funeral. The criticism mainly centered around bin Salman's role in the murder and dismemberment of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. His fiancée has called for bin Salman to be arrested for murder when he arrived in London. A number of rights campaigners also cited excessive domestic repression and Saudi Arabia's deadly war against Yemen. They said the occasion would give bin Salman another chance to whitewash his human rights record. According to sources, another Saudi prince would represent the kingdom at the funeral. Earlier, we spoke to our London correspondent, Tamina Taylor. She doesn't rule out the Saudi crown prince showing up for the Queen's funeral, despite reports to the contrary.
You know, for me, this is a very, what do they say? It kind of smells like three-day-old fish, this particular decision, because just earlier on Press TV, we were discussing this very issue about just how horrible the optics were for a man who, inside his very own cabal, would have ordered the brutal execution of a dissident journalist inside the Saudi consulate in another country. So let's just look at the audacity of that, just as for starters. So whomever, wherever this decision came from, whether or not the palace could see that the optics were not good and perhaps had a word, perhaps MBS himself would have seen that there were just too many people who now knew where he was going to be, what that meant in terms of the focus being on the most appalling aspects of his regime, or even the British government, who might have had a word to say, listen, we'd love you to come, but politically it's a rough time right now. Why don't you just send someone in? Or this is a big smokescreen, and the man will fly in on his private jet, and we'll see him on Monday, sitting front and center, and then he'll fly off. Because these things are about PR, catching your opponents off guard, trying to upset just how people think things might be happening, and then spring in a fast one. So, Kaveh, I personally would not be surprised if tomorrow we saw him show up, because this is just, it's curious. It's a curious decision at this point.
The UK's Prime Minister is under pressure over an economic crisis exacerbated by soaring energy prices as warnings are issued of mass bankruptcies across the country. Liz Truss has unveiled a sweeping package of support for Britons facing soaring energy bills, but much of its detail has remained unpublished. Now, media reports say leading UK business organizations are warning of dire consequences if they continue to be left in limbo over the level of government support. They asked government ministers to show clarity on what help the government could offer them with their energy bills. Experts say many businesses have seen their energy costs skyrocket by 300% compared with last year, putting their future at risk. That's as inflation has hit heights not seen for 30 years, while the pound has sunk to a 37-year low. Thousands of Moldovans have hit the streets of the capital, Chisinau, to protest their government's policies to tackle high inflation and fuel prices. The demonstrators chanted slogans against officials and demanded the resignation of pro-Western President Maia Sandu and her government. It was the largest protest in the tiny ex-Soviet state since Sandu was elected in a landslide victory in 2020 on pledges to root out corruption, but she stands accused of causing an economic crisis. Meanwhile, she has promised to secure a membership of the European Union, which has provided significant amounts of aid to the country. Hurricane Fiona has made landfall in Puerto Rico, knocking out all power and threatening to cause catastrophic flooding in the U.S. island territory. Packing winds of 140 kilometers per hour, Fiona is forecast to strengthen further in the next 48 hours as it sweeps across Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic before heading north into the open waters of the Atlantic. Weather forecasts predict life-threatening flash flooding of streams, highways and streets, as well as urban, low-lying and poorly drained areas. Residents have been asked not to leave their homes and go to shelters if they are in areas prone to landslides and flooding. A state of emergency has been declared in Puerto Rico. The United States is heaping up pressure on Russia on all fronts, from economic sanctions to diplomatic restrictions. But the White House has now gone a step further by telling South Africa not to associate with Russia at all. The South African president has hit back, saying it's not for Washington to decide who his country can or cannot do business with. The move may further alienate the U.S. when it comes to Africa as a whole.
On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. You said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they have been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices, neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain?
When it comes to investment in Africa, China tops the list of foreign countries. A conservative estimate puts Chinese investment at $126 billion from 2001 to 2018. The figure has increased even further since then. Russia comes in at $20 billion per year, while the U.S. invested almost $45 billion in 2020. Washington's incoherent policy towards Africa may be the reason why it has fallen behind.
South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, holds the same view as the South African president when it comes to Russia. She referenced the Soviet Union's championing of anti-apartheid forces, compared with Western cooperation with South Africa's former white supremacist regime. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Successive U.S. administrations have tried to penetrate the African political and economic landscape, but it looks like their efforts have not succeeded, lagging one step behind other powers like China and Russia. The Ukraine conflict is clear proof of that. This is one of the occasions that many nations have been reluctant to embrace the West in its campaign to pressure Moscow. But that is not the only time that a considerable portion of an entire continent does not give importance to U.S. pressure. Recently, snubs from key leaders at the Summit of the Americas revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's struggle to assert U.S. leadership in his neighborhood. The issue of U.S. leadership being questioned begs the question, where else is the U.S. leadership under doubt? From Latin America to Africa to West Asia, all the way to Asia and China in particular, the U.S. is losing support from countries around the world. That is why the phrase "the U.S. losing its superpower status" continues to reverberate in many countries. But perhaps one of the tools that the U.S. uses, which has had a strong backlash, making it fall out of favor with many countries, is the use of sanctions and the use of the dollar as a weapon. Many countries view this as a form of bullying for countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, which is probably why the South African president has said, "We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with."
Palestinian schools in occupied Al-Quds will observe a day-long strike on Monday in protests against Israel's attempts to impose distorted textbooks. The Palestinian National and Islamic Forces, a coalition of political factions, has called for the strike. It says the walkout is aimed at reaffirming the right of Palestinian children to be taught their own curriculum, not the distorted one. The group also called on international institutions to press the regime not to interfere in the affairs of the Palestinian schools. On Saturday, parents and students held protests in several neighborhoods against Israel's attempts to prevent schools from teaching the official Palestinian textbooks. They decried Israel's disregard of their rights and chanted slogans such as no to the distorted curriculum and no to Judaizing education. The Palestinians say the regime is trying to deny students their right to learn their own history and culture. Shock and outrage has spread across the British black community as an investigation into the police shooting of an unarmed black man in South London has begun. Chris Cabell was killed at the start of the month, and his death has many activists claiming it was an unjust killing by a racist police force. Robert Carter reports on the latest protest in London.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carver was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organisers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing.
On behalf of the family, I want to thank everyone for coming. Mum and dad couldn't make it. Like, emotionally, it was just too much for them. But they did send a message saying thank you and that they appreciate all your love and support and your kindness, and it means the world to them, especially during these trying times. As you know, a lot of you know that yesterday we did go to see the body.
News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them.
Do you know what? Thank goodness that they've decided not to arm the entire police force, because if that was the case, then I think that would be a cause for concern. Because obviously they're demonstrating themselves to be quite trigger happy.
Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, Press London.
That's a wrap for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new book by the New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman has claimed that in the days after Joe Biden defeated him in the 2020 election, former President Donald Trump told an aide he was just not going to leave the White House. Stay with us for more details. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story. The Guardian says, in the days after Joe Biden defeated him in the 2020 election, former President Donald Trump told an aide he was just not going to leave the White House, according to a new book on his presidency and its chaotic aftermath. We're never leaving, Donald Trump vowed to another aide, says the book from New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman. The book is titled Confidence Man: The Making of Donald Trump and the Breaking of America. How can you leave when you won an election? CNN, where Maggie Haberman also serves as a political analyst, said on Monday it reviewed reporting for the book, set for a 4th of October release, and published new details on Donald Trump's insistence that he intended to stay at the White House despite his electoral loss to Biden. The book reports Trump being overheard whining and asking Republican National Committee Chairperson Ronna McDaniel, why should I leave if they stole it from me? None of Donald Trump's predecessors had ever threatened to remain at the White House after the end of their presidencies. The only remotely close parallel was the former First Lady Mary Todd Lincoln, who remained at the White House for just a few weeks after the assassination of her husband, Abraham Lincoln, in April of 1865, according to Maggie Haberman's book. Donald Trump's private bluster about refusing to move out of the White House contradicted public statements he made to reporters less than a month after the election that he would certainly leave if Biden's victory over him was certified. I will, and you know that, Donald Trump said, though he insisted electoral fraudsters had robbed him of beating Biden. Additionally, Maggie Haberman's book portrays Trump as picking the brains of virtually everyone in his orbit for their thoughts on his camp's idea and how to keep him in the Oval Office despite Biden's win. Among those consulted was the valet who would ferry Diet Cokes to Trump whenever he pressed the red button on the presidential desk in the Oval Office, according to the book. Donald Trump, of course, eventually relented and moved out on the same day as Joe Biden's inauguration, sparing authorities from having to forcibly escort him out of the White House at the behest of the new president. Trump supporters who bought his lies that he'd been defrauded of victory in the 2020 race staged a deadly U.S. Capitol attack on 6th of January 2021. A bipartisan Senate committee report linked 7 deaths at the violence on that day, which was aimed at preventing the congressional certification of Joe Biden's victory. Federal prosecutors later filed criminal charges against more than 800 participants, many of whom have already been convicted and sentenced to prison. A bipartisan House committee earlier this year held a series of public hearings making the case that, among other things, Donald Trump apparently violated federal law when he ignored pleas to take action that would halt his supporters' assault on the Capitol. Later on Monday, the New York Times reported that the Justice Department had issued about 40 subpoenas over the past week seeking information about the actions of Trump and his associates related to the 6th of January 2021 attack. 2 of Donald Trump's advisers have had their cell phones seized, according to the New York Times. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story, but from a different angle. Congresswoman Liz Cheney said Donald Trump's unwillingness to leave the White House after being defeated in the 2020 presidential election affirms the reality of the danger of its efforts to overturn the election. Liz Cheney made the remarks in response to revelations made in a new book by New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, which claimed that the former president told his aides that he would remain in the White House even after Joe Biden's inauguration. According to Maggie Haberman's soon-to-be-released book, Confidence Man, The Making of Donald Trump and the Breaking of America, the 45th president reportedly told his aides, "I'm just not going to leave the White House. We're never leaving. How can you leave when you have won an election?" Liz Cheney, who is one of two Republicans on the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol riot, said, "It wasn't surprising that those are the sentiments that Donald Trump reportedly expressed. In a lot of ways, people say it wasn't as dangerous as it really was," she told CNN on Monday. Liz Cheney added, "And when you hear something like that, I think you have to recognize that we were in no man's land and territory we'd never been in before as a nation. And if you have a president who's refusing to leave the White House, or who's saying he refuses to leave the White House, then anyone who sort of understands a side and says someone else will handle it is themselves putting the nation at risk. Because it's clear that when you're at a moment that we faced, everyone's got to stand up and take responsibility," Liz Cheney said. "I think, again, it just affirms the reality of the danger."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion on how Arba'in procession will revive the Husseini movement all around the world, we have two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Habib. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Brother and Habib.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me. It's always an honor and pleasure to be with you.
You're welcome, Brother. So for today's discussion, we want to talk about forming Shia community and the role of the majalis, or it's better to say somehow the majlis or majalis, refer to these gatherings and the ceremonies and the sessions that are held for commemorating the Ahlul Bayt, especially Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In brief, what is the role of the majlis in forming the Shia community in and outside, we can say, the majlis? Okay, Brother Habib, let's start with you, brother.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A man was heard by Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam stating, "Oh Allah, let me finish off from the people. Let me be self-sufficient from people." Imam Sajjad alayhi salam told him, "No, not like that. Do not pray and supplicate like that. Innama an-nasu bin-nas. People are for people. People need people. Rather say, Allahumma ighdini an shirari khalqika," the rest of the supplication. The idea that I want to take from this saying is that people need people. We are, as human beings, what they call in philosophy, madaniyun bit-tab', which is pretty much a social human being.
Yes, social.
We need other people. We need someone to build the houses. We need for that person that's building the houses to help him get married. We need that person that is helping him get married to make the bread, to make the water, to bring the water, to fix this, to do this, and to do that. We need each other. We need a community. And how does this usually happen? There has to be a place where we see each other. If each one of us is sitting in their house, not going to gatherings, not sitting with each other, we cannot build a community. We cannot see the needs of our brothers in faith and humanity. And that is why we have in the sayings that rebuke and criticize the concept of i'tizal, which is to abandon society, to abandon community. We have this concept that, why is it rebuked by the Imam alayhi salam? Imam alayhi salam says, how does this person that learned his religion, how does this person learn his religion? How does this person teach his religion? How does this person help his brothers and sisters? So it's very important.
Having a solitary life.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
So it's very important to build the community, to see each other, to sit down with each other. And what better way than to revive the remembrance of the Imam alayhi salam while doing so. When we do so, we see each other, we're gaining knowledge, we're remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we're doing the purpose of our life and the purpose of this community and helping out this community. So, ahyu amrana, revive our remembrance.
Remembrance, that's all right. And so as you said, the pivot of the Shia community could be the majalis of the Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
Whether it is the happy one or the sad one.
Yes, okay. The happy one and the sad ones. But at the end of the day, you're remembering the Imam alayhi salam. It doesn't always have to be for an occasion. Mm-hmm. This is, I feel like, a misconception in our societies. Because the saying was available talking about the topic and the concept of knowledge.
Yes.
Of gaining knowledge. They usually, the scholars state this in the sayings for to gain knowledge, to sit down in the majalis of knowledge, of ilm. Majalis al-ilm. There is no knowledge other than Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. Keep this as something in your minds, brothers and sisters. So at the end of the day, ahyu amrana, remember, how do you remember the Imam alayhum as-salam? You bring up their fada'il, their merits. You bring up their knowledge. And when you bring up the knowledge, you bring up the halal, the haram. What Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants from us. Theology, our ideology, how to deal with society altogether. Then knowledge calls for amal. Inna al-ilma yunadi bil-amal. It calls al-amal, action. Therefore, one of the actions that we learn from the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam is helping our brothers and sisters, which pretty much what does? Builds a community.
That's right.
You learn, you get to know new people, you get to know the new Shia members, you get to know their kids, their children, their families, their problems, their backgrounds, and this builds a community.
That's all right. Okay, Shaykh, what about you? How do you find the role of the majlis in forming Shia community?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The role of Majlis is, of course, very much significant and important. Once I was studying about the history of Shia communities in Britain, I saw very nice kind of documents about this making and forming these small communities in Britain for decades back. They were very much small communities, some 2, 3, 4 people were gathering in a very small kind of majlis and commemorating this event of Ashura and Muharram. But you see, nowadays, we have sometimes thousands of people who gather in different majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. So the start point of these majalis were those kind of small majalis that causes building these great or major and also kind of big communities nowadays, large communities and Britain. And same is the case with the Shia Muslims, alhamdulillah, in Australia, in the United States, in Canada. So nowadays, they have this majalis, alhamdulillah, the communities. Yes. But of course, there are some Shia Muslims still who have no community. Unfortunately, they are living a kind of isolated kind of lives, and they have no any contact, any communication with other Muslims.
Or maybe they are under the control or surveillance of a country or government. They are not allowed sometimes to shape a community.
Yeah, that's why I think since most of these countries respect multicultural kind of societies, that's why I think for Muslims it is a very good opportunity to gather, to start this majalis and to make Islamic Muslim community. Of course, it will preserve and keep the identities of their children. Because, you know, all the parents in those countries, Muslim parents, parents and families, they want to have their own Islamic identity, Shia identity. It's the huwiyah or the identity for their children is very much important, significant to be preserved in this modern time.
That's right.
So this is the only way that they can keep and preserve this Muslim and Shia and Mu'min identity for their children by taking part to these kind of majalis, by forming these Shia kind of communities. They should gather, they should form these communities. And of course, the start point can be from these majalis, whether right. sometimes these majalis might be very mm-hmm. small.
Yes,
so some of those cities, there yes, are very few number of Shia Muslims.
Yes.
But they should gather, they should mm-hmm. start. And then one day they will have a very great kind of majalis and communities, mm-hmm. and they will help their children to gain the knowledge that my brother mentioned, the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt.
That's right.
So this is very much important to be a Muslim, to live a true Muslim. So how? So we have to gain the knowledge of being true Muslim. Mm-hmm. How? One of the ways that we can acquire these kind of knowledges through this majalis of Ahlul Bayt.
That's right.
Because in modern schools, in modern universities, in those kind of educational systems, there's nothing about Ahlul Bayt, nothing about Islamic identity. So that's why I think it is a must for our Muslim brothers in those countries to unite, mm-hmm. to unite themselves, to make these kind of communities, and of course to hold these majalis and commemorate Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu
wasalam. I just want to add something
okay, very
to
good.
What my brother was saying. You don't always have to unite, so, because sometimes the problems are there. There was even the time of the Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. There was this dispute between Hisham ibn al-Hakam and Hisham ibn al-Salim. Mm-hmm. To one of the greatest companions of the Imam alayhum as-salam. Both of them were not friends with each other to a point where the students of Hisham ibn Salim would not pray behind the students of Hisham al-Hakam. That was during the time of the Imam alayhi salam. For more like information about this, one could review Kitab al-Kishi. The idea is to at least start off the majalis. Mm. It's not don't cancel out starting the majalis because this person is going to talk. No, you have yourself. You have this like four or five people around you. You need someone with knowledge as well to be available in your majalis, which we're available at your service, and pretty much, you know, to kind of guide you guys to the right path to gaining knowledge from the Imam alayhum as-salam. We always need that scholar around you to help you out. And I think that, Sheikh, we have to agree on this, that us foreign-speaking students available in Qom, in Najaf, some kind of burden is on our shoulder, some kind of, we have been lacking in intense. I think that we need to put in more energy to give back to the community.
That's right.
And hopefully the community will accept it.
That's all right.
One point which is very much important, while we form some communities and hold some majalis, we must be very much careful and mindful of this, that we should not harm and annoy others. Mm-hmm. We should not do anything in opposite to the rules, to the establishment.
Stick to your goals, stick to yourself.
Yeah.
Don't try burn down another,
I mean, you have to
thing.
Hold your own majalis. Do not disturb others, do not annoy others.
Yes.
Respect others, behave others with Islamic kind of
especially
rituals,
because you are the minority in that country,
course.
You cannot do that.
It is the thing that we should observe.
Okay,
should
act
be,
again,
we should
against
be
this establishment. Yeah. That's all right. But I think organizing a majlis, needs its own, we can say, expertise, Brother Habib, isn't it?
Yes, it does.
How to establish a majlis or how to organize a majlis?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
So how should we do that?
It has its own morals. It has its own, let's say, rules that are, you know, kind of available out there that people usually know them. Usually, for example, sometimes that people remind them. I was following an English lecture in Leicester. I remember that the guys were speaking that do not leave your cars over there. He was before the speaker came. And when the speaker came, I turned that off, actually, because it was a 12-minute reminder of the rules of the majlis. So the idea is that there has to be some kind of, you know, like any other ceremony that you have, there has to be some kinds of guidelines over there. What are we going to do? What are the goals? Who should speak? Who should talk? Knowing to bring which speaker. Don't bring anyone. I mean, for example, the 10 days of Muharram. These 10 days are to remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam, to know if those who believe that it was a movement or a revolution, to look at it. Those people who believe it was an oppression against the Imam alayhi salam, to look at it, to cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Not to be bashing and stab and backbiting other mm-hmm. Shia clergies or, I don't know, this kind of topic and this useless topic. At least talk about the topics that the Shias need at that community.
Yes.
I mean, we're losing ourselves to the liberals.
That's right.
We are losing ourselves to liberals. We can't deny it. I can't deny it. Because I've seen my family members that have been affected very highly by the liberals, that you bring up an authentic, well-accepted Islamic idea, accepted by all Muslims, they will disagree with it. Mm-hmm. They will have a problem with it. Why? Because their ideology is not well-built. We need, as scholars, we need to come together. And when we talk something that is useful for that community. Do not be talking about about this or that are useless. This scholar said that and that scholar said that. Or for example, talking about or being afraid to talk about topics. Why? Because people will cancel you. Because people will not accept you. If people are not going to accept you, don't go over there. Go somewhere else. That community does not want to learn. That community does not want to change. It wants someone to talk, and the talker is their audience.
That's all right. Sometimes we lose the main goal, we can't say, behind holding a majlis.
Exactly, perfectly put, brother.
Yeah, for the a'immas, what is the majlis for? The majlis is not like, for example, a party. This is not a party, okay? This is not a parliament. This is not a party. This is not a friendly session. This is the majlis, and the majlis needs its own, we can't say, prerequisites. And as I said, the organizers must, they themselves, be very much careful of who to involve and how to take, for example, the youth into the scene, the women into the scene, okay? And this is really important, I seem to hold the majlis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the other a'immas. Okay, thank you much, Brother Habib and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the role of the majlis in forming Shia community, both inside and outside the Shia world. It is very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. And another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Allahumma ja'al mahya ya mahya Muhammad wa ala Muhammad ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد. I swear to Allah, you have shown us so much courage through the pain. You sacrificed your family and were killed thirsty, oh Hussein.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Business Roundtable aims to weaken efforts that would enable investors to hold companies accountable for their climate promises. We now present you an article written by Adam Lowenstein under the heading, How a Top US Business Lobby Promised Climate Action but Worked to Block Efforts. 3 years ago, in a statement, America's most powerful and politically connected corporations promised to protect the environment by embracing sustainable practices across American businesses. The statement on the purpose of a corporation came from the Business Roundtable, an influential Washington, D.C. lobbying group whose 200-plus members include the chief executives of some of the world's biggest companies, such as Apple, Pepsi, Walmart, and Google. Now, on the statement's third anniversary, the Business Roundtable and its member CEOs continue to issue earnest statements about the climate crisis. But the organization is also working diligently and spending liberally to weaken efforts that would enable investors to hold companies accountable for their climate promises. An analysis by The Guardian found the lobby group has worked hard to protect the status quo in which corporations generate goodwill and positive public relations by publishing bold climate goals, with little fear of being held accountable or legally liable for achieving those goals. Can choose to selectively disclose certain parts of their carbon footprint or none at all. Are not required to reveal the greenhouse gas emissions generated throughout their supply chains, which for most companies make up the majority of their emissions. Make high-profile pledges to fight climate change while paying to maintain memberships in the Business Roundtable and other trade associations that spend millions of dollars to lobby governments against meaningful climate action. In public, the Business Roundtable's leaders are still committed to change. Doug McMillon, the chief executive officer of Walmart and previous chair of the Business Roundtable, has claimed the climate crisis one of the greatest challenges facing the planet today. In a statement on the group's website, Mary Barra, the chief executive officer of General Motors and the Roundtable's current chair, declared that we must act to tackle climate change. Johnson Controls Chief Executive Officer George Oliver, in a video published by the Business Roundtable in January, said the challenge isn't a lack of business commitment, adding, "What we need is to be aligned with the public sector to make sure that we've got the proper policies in place that will enable us to do what we do so well." Yet, when the US government has tried to put the proper policies in place, the Business Roundtable has worked to undermine those efforts. In 2021, the organization spent millions of dollars to stop the Biden administration's Build Back Better agenda, which included significant efforts to purportedly reduce carbon emissions and promote clean energy. And this year, after the US Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, proposed a long-anticipated rule that would require publicly held companies to disclose their carbon emissions and the risk that climate change poses to their business models, the Business Roundtable declared its opposition to central aspects of the Securities and Exchange Commission proposal, including provisions that experts say are vital for the rule to give investors comparable and consistent information about corporations' climate risks. Before releasing the proposed rules in March, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, had asked the public what such rules might look like. In its response, the Business Roundtable acknowledged that climate challenges are creating growing risks in many parts of the economy and deemed it appropriate for the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, to regulate climate disclosures. The group admitted that the present system of corporate climate reporting, in which some companies issue voluntary climate-related disclosures, has proven inadequate. But when the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, shifted from requesting voluntary input to proposing mandatory requirements for climate disclosures, the organization appeared to change its tune. In a 17-page letter, the chief executive officer, Lobby, announced its opposition to the proposal and asked the commission to revise and repropose the rule. In an email to The Guardian, the Business Roundtable denied that its perspective had changed. It claimed Business Roundtable members are committed to combating climate change and are supportive of a rulemaking. The group said, "Our goal is for a pragmatic, attainable and successful rule," adding, "Our members believe it is worth the extra time on the front end to repropose the rule." According to meeting memoranda published by the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, since April of 2021, the Business Roundtable has met at least three times with the SEC about climate disclosures. According to reports compiled by Open Secrets, in the first half of this year, the group sent more than $9.1 million lobbying the federal government directly. In its public disclosures, the roundtable reported lobbying Congress, the White House, and the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Council, about the climate disclosure proposal. In an email, the Business Roundtable said it met with the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, to directly communicate their concerns and shared their point of view with members of Congress and administration officials. Despite asking for a new and thus delayed proposal, the organization's own members continue to assure the public that they see the climate crisis as an urgent challenge. Cummins, chief executive officer and Business Roundtable member Tom Linebarger, said in the organization's January climate video, "We're out of time. We're getting ready to get ready to do things. And the problem is that we have to move now." But now, it seems, does not mean now. One provision the Business Roundtable has rejected as unworkable is a requirement for companies to measure and report the greenhouse gas emissions generated by their suppliers and customers throughout their supply chains, or what are known as Scope 3 emissions. The provision would apply only to companies that have published emission targets that include Scope 3, or for which supply chain emissions are considered material. Scope 3 includes all greenhouse gas emissions that companies neither generate directly, Scope 1, nor purchase for their own energy needs, Scope 2, which means everything from the raw materials that go into creating a product to the transportation that delivers that product to a consumer. For most companies, Scope 3 emissions represents the majority of their carbon output. As Adisu Lashitu, a fellow at Brookings Institution, has pointed out, more than three-quarters of Amazon's 2021 emissions were considered Scope 3. The Business Roundtable supports mandating Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions disclosures, and many companies already report them, in part because these direct emissions are easier to calculate and easier to reduce, sometimes through the purchase of dubious carbon offsets. In its comments to the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, the Business Roundtable called the proposal to require companies to measure and report Scope 3 emissions overly burdensome, because many companies still have limited systems in place to identify and disclose Scope 3 emissions, and some aspects of reporting value chain emissions remain challenging. But Alison Heron-Lee, the former acting chair and commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, told The Guardian, "If you don't have Scope 3 as a requirement, then what you have effectively done is cut out most of the emissions from the top emitting industries. with emissions arguably being the most important item of disclosure for investors, how is a rule without Scope 3 going to achieve what investors need? The Business Roundtable said in an email, "There is an inherent degree of uncertainty in some of the data the proposal would require companies to disclose, and much of it is largely outside of their control." A number of experts familiar with the Securities and Exchange Council's climate disclosure rulemaking acknowledge that tracking and reporting Scope 3 emissions could indeed be difficult for some companies, or at least more difficult than not doing so. But they suggested that the more fundamental question was not whether complying with the SEC's rules would be more difficult than doing nothing, but rather, if doing so would provide investors with information that they have requested, and that would help them make more informed investment decisions. This argument would appear to align with the stated position of the Business Roundtable, which has repeatedly expressed its support for market-based efforts to address climate change, a view it reiterated in its comments to the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC. George S. Georgiev, a professor at Emory University in Georgia and an expert on securities law, told The Guardian, "Information is the lifeblood of the capital markets, and capital markets are a central institution of a capitalist market economy," adding, "Climate-related financial information is demanded by investors, not by environmentalists." In its comments, the Business Roundtable said that its member companies had already set a high bar for voluntary environmental, social and governance disclosures, or ESG disclosures, and that a voluntary approach to climate reporting was already providing more valuable information for investors. But many investors, analysts and academics, voters and experts, even companies themselves, disagree. Emory University's Georgiev said, "There is near universal agreement among scholars that voluntary disclosure rules alone are not sufficient. The same logic applies to climate rules."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.